Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. On behalf of Message, Mormons for Equality and Social Justice, it's a pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to the first of two Message sessions in co-sponsorship with the Sunstone Symposium, whose guests we are today. My name is Robert Port. I'm a member of the small staff of Message, and I'm one of the organizers, which is one of the organizations who founded Mormons for Equality of Social Justice in 2002. A little bit more about Message. Some people have heard about the word Message, but don't really know what Message is all about. In the session after this, you'll hear more about us. We actually have, I think, five speakers in the next session in the same room who will talk a lot about social activism and various parts of the goals of Message as an organization. From our mission statement, very shortly, Message, Mormons for Equality and Social Justice, is a grassroots organization of Latter-day Saints individuals who are anxiously engaged in working for the gospel values of peace, equality, justice, and wise stewardship of the earth, in a spirit of Christ-like charity and concern. And like I said, in the session after this, you'll hear just a whole lot more about Message. And if you want to find out even more, you need to go to our website, which is message.org, M-E-S-J.org. This first session is also a first of its kind for a relatively young organization. We are gathered here together to give William van Wagenen the annual Helmut Hübner Award. And what is and why do we have a Helmut Hübner Award? Just a question, how many of you are actually familiar with the person of Helmut Hübner? Very good, so I don't have to tell you the whole story. Actually, you can learn a lot by looking at the DVD, Truth and Conviction, the Helmut Hübner story, which is available in just about any church bookstore. So he's really very familiar historic figure in our church. Message, as a social justice organization, is always looking for role models to inspire and teach. We think of role models like Mahatma Gandhi, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King, Sojourner's Truth, and we're always looking for more. As a Christian organization, a Christian social justice organization, Message obviously recognizes as her greatest role model Jesus Christ, who brought the good news to the poor and the captive. And within the context of our mission, we speak therefore about the gospel values of equality, social justice, peace, and stewardship of the earth. And many of us within Message indeed feel that as Latter-day Saints, we are on a mission through a lifelong commitment to the principles of equality, social justice, peace, and stewardship of the earth. And as Latter-day Saints, in the Mormon faith tradition, we emulate the Savior and recognize that many follow in his footsteps in many different ways. In this special session, we are honored to be with our fellow Latter-day Saint and friend William van Wagenen, who literally followed in the footsteps of the Savior, and he will explain why that is and why that was. He was in the Middle East as a member of CPT, the Christian Peacemakers Team. But let's first talk a little bit about Helmut Hübner, even though most of us seem to be familiar with him. As most of us may know, that Helmut Hübner was a young man, young Latter-day Saint, growing up in the city of Hamburg in Germany in the early years of the war, Second World War. And he distributed pamphlets, leaflets, criticizing, protesting the Nazi regime, and which is quite remarkable, I would say, for a 15-year-old Latter-day Saint in such a small Latter-day Saint community. One of his quotes on his leaflets, and I'm going to read it very shortly in German to you. And then I'll give you the Dutch, the German translation. Quote from Helmut Hübner. Das Jahr 1942 wird die Entscheidung bringen. Vielleicht im Osten, in Afrika oder gar in Asien. Das glaubt auch Hitler wohl selber nicht. Die Entscheidung wird es an einem anderen Platz fallen. Sie wird fallen, wenn dem schon lange in Finsternis gehaltenen deutschen Volk ein Licht aufgeht, wenn es der unsäglichen Kriegslasten müde ist und gerne die Bürde abwerfen möchte. Maybe some of you speak German. Our Helmut Hübner Award recipient today, William, went on a mission in Germany, so he certainly understood that. And he'll tell you a lot more about his experiences. But the translation is, Helmut Hübner writes his leaflet and he claims, Hitler claims that the, and be very observant about the relevance to our day when you think of war and the time we live in. Hitler claims that the year 1942 is going to make a difference. You don't think he believes that himself, do you? It will be different, all right, but in a very different way than you may think. The German people, kept in darkness for so long, will come to see the light when she grows tired of the unbearable yoke of the sufferings of war, and will be more than happy to get rid of that yoke. You only have to replace a word or two, and you'll find yourself in 2007. Working for peace is not just a soft ideal, as some people may perceive it. It's not for softies. Working for peace is hard labor. It has been said that waging war is an easy way out of conflict, whereas waging peace is what makes a real man or a real woman. Also, working toward peace is not without consequences. It comes with a price, as William himself has experienced firsthand. And certainly, those familiar with the Helmut Hübner story know that he too paid actually the ultimate price for his peaceful and courageous protest. Helmut Hübner was a 15-year-old man with a natural passion for truth and conviction. And for us as Mormons, it isn't very hard to see how young Helmut Hübner resembles the young prophet Joseph Smith, another champion for truth and consequences. And as Latter-day Saints, we often talk about moral issues, and in this historical context, and in hindsight, it's certainly clear that the National Socialism of Hitler, of Adolf Hitler, was plain and simple immorality. And it isn't so clear. It wasn't so clear, however, to the members of his ward in 1942 in Hamburg, a big city in northern Germany. On the contrary, he was excommunicated from his ward, from the church, for his actions, even though he was later, after his death, reinstated as a member. The thing is that as Latter-day Saints, we are at times quick to condemn and excommunicate, and very slow to recognize and appreciate true heroes and pioneers that are a lot braver than ourselves. A classic example is also, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King, champion for equality and human rights, who was actually very much despised and rejected as a communist troublemaker. And even today, we hardly hear his name mentioned in church circles, maybe somewhat confirming our lingering fears and prejudice. In the case of Helmut Hübner, we see some of this reluctance to stand for truth and consequence in our faith community. Besides the wonderful initiatives of a theater play, the DVD Truth and Conviction, and of course Sunstone Publications about the life and times of Helmut Hübner, as a church we really haven't come to terms with the role of civil rights activists, leave alone to embrace them and to be inspired by their examples. This initiative of Message hopes to the initiative to give an award in the name of Helmut Hübner hopes to create a new tradition: the presentation of the annual Helmut Hübner Award to an individual or group that has been exemplary in working towards the gospel values of equality, social justice, peace, and wise stewardship of the earth. In my initial contact with our award recipient William, I sensed his modesty, and he was trying to downplay his actions somewhat. He was saying, well, I really don't deserve it and all that, but as message, we really felt it was an easy decision to present him with the award. In short, we really feel he qualifies. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him. Wil van Wagenen was born in, and he'll correct me where I go wrong, was born in West Valley City, Utah. I believe West Valley, that's very close here, right? He served an LDS mission to Frankfurt, Germany, and then graduated from Brigham Young University with a BA degree in German. He also played 4 years for the BYU's men's soccer team. And while at BYU, Will began studying Arabic and studied Arabic for one semester at the Birzeit University in occupied Palestine in the winter of 2003. And while at Birzeit, Will saw the terrible realities of life under Israeli occupation firsthand, and he attended later Harvard University, taking a master's degree in theological studies. His studies focused on Arabic, Islam, and Middle East politics. Upon graduating from Harvard in 2005, Will volunteered for 4 months in Baghdad, Iraq, with Christian Peacemaker Teams, the CPT, documenting abuses by the newly created Iraq security forces and helping Iraqis locate relatives detained in U.S. or coalition prisons. Will volunteered with CPT, the Christian Peacemaker Teams, again from November 2006 to February 2007, this time working in the Kurdish Autonomous Region, and focused on helping victims of human trafficking. While in Iraq, this second time, he was kidnapped and held hostage for 9 days in northern Iraq from January 27th until February the 4th on 2007. The Deseret News, a very prominent newspaper, of course, here in Utah, published two very, very good articles about him. Maybe you've read them. And this, in short, a little bit about our award recipient. And more than any introduction can possibly achieve, the personal report of his motivation and experience by William himself will probably do a better job than I can ever do. It's now my pleasure to present the award to William. Before I do that, I'd like to mention that this first year where we hand out present the award, the Helmut Hübner Award, hopefully becoming the first year of a long tradition. We have an added bonus for the recipient. It's an airline ticket, good for a round trip anywhere in the world for the purpose of promoting gospel values of equality, social justice, peace, and stewardship of the earth. And we'll hope that we'll put it to good use. I'm sure he has a good purpose for it. So having said that, I'll have William stand next to me here. We're going to make this a little official. All right. Well, Will, we've met before. The official phraseology is, today, the 9th of August, 2007, Message Mormons for Equality and Social Justice is honored to present a 2007 Helmut Hübner Award to William Clifton van Wagenen for his exemplary service for the cause of peace. And as fellow members of Message, we are proud to be associated with you, William, and more importantly, we are very much inspired by your example to be a bit more courageous ourselves in working for peace. Thank you.
Maybe 15 minutes. All right, well, it's really nice to get the award. I was hoping that Robert wouldn't mention the airline ticket since my since my dad's in the room, and I thought I could maybe keep that secret from him. But In his defense, he's the one who actually bought me my first ticket to Baghdad, so maybe it's okay that he knows about it. But obviously, it's a huge honor to be compared to Helmut Hubner. I obviously can think of a lot of ways in which I shouldn't be compared to him. And in thinking about that, one of the things that I really think is amazing about Helmut was that he lived at a time in Nazi Germany when the war hadn't been brought back to Germany itself. You know, German armies had invaded all these other countries, and the Germans themselves maybe didn't know a whole lot about how the war was going. They were subject to a lot of government propaganda. There wasn't a free press, and, you know, people, just like here in the United States, at that time were pretty, quick to believe what the government said. And anyways, none of the terrible effects of World War II had hit Germans yet. You know, the United States, you know, was not yet, bombing German cities and things like this. And so by all accounts, it looked like the war for the Germans was going really well at that time. You know, Hitler was on a roll. And that's one, and most Germans seemed to support it. There were very few dissenters, which is maybe because it was a police state and people were very scared. But it's just very interesting that in spite of the fact that none of the bad consequences of the war had yet hit Germans as a people, that Helmut Hubner was able to realize that something was wrong or that something wasn't right, see through the German propaganda, and go to these great lengths to get a radio, go to his, I think it was his grandmother's house, and listen up in the attic to these BBC broadcasts in German about what the British were saying about the war, and then have the initiative to go around, you know, print up these pamphlets, some of which were just direct, quotations of what he heard on the BBC, and other things were things that he composed himself. But it was just amazing that a young kid like that, all by himself, thought it was that important to do the right thing, even though no one around him agreed, and to risk his life like that. I mean, he must have known that there was a good chance that he would get caught. Again, you know, Germany was a police state. The Nazis had spies everywhere. While at BYU, I read a play by the German Marxist author Bertolt Brecht that, tried to kind of dramatize what society must have been like in Nazi Germany at that period of time, and how, you know, parents would be worried as they were talking about politics or saying anything critical about the Nazi regime, because they didn't know if their kids were hearing what they were saying, because their kids were going off to these Nazi youth activities, kind of like we have Boy Scouts today. Not that the Boy Scouts are the Nazi youth, although I never liked Scouts much, but kids were going off to these Nazi youth activities, in at least according to this play by Bertolt Brecht, who, you know, was living in Germany until finally he went into exile in Sweden, being a communist. Obviously, the Nazis and the communists didn't get along too well, and communists were some of Hitler's first targets when he came to power. But in the way Brecht dramatized things at the time is that everyone was very scared to say anything against the government, and again, even you're worried if your kids heard, because maybe they'd go to their Nazi youth meeting and report on their parents and tell, you know, the Nazis what their parents had said. And so this was, you know, the kind of fear that existed at the time. And so for Helmut to do what he did under those circumstances was just, it's really actually quite hard to believe. And if we look at the conditions that we live in here in the United States, where, you know, there's a war going on, and a lot of people realize that, you know, the reasons that the government gave for going to war weren't correct. A lot of people realize that, the war was fought for economic and geopolitical reasons. And, a lot of people are hearing about, you know, torture going on in secret prisons or in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib. We know about all these things in a way that probably even Helmut Hubner wasn't able to know about them with that same degree of surety. And yet, instead of just kind of going about his life and doing what he was doing and having fun with his friends and going out and playing soccer or you know, maybe trying to make a lot of money or going to school so he could get a good job, you know, when he was older, Instead, he spent all of his time and energy putting out these pamphlets against the Nazis, who, where he knew that his activities weren't going to end the war. You know, what difference could have his few pamphlets that he was spreading around his neighborhood have made? And yet, that's how he spent all of his time, and that was his main priority. And you know, he knew, I'm sure, maybe he didn't even know he would get killed, but for sure he knew he would be in prison for a long time. And of course, that's what happened. Finally, the secret police found out about it, came, arrested him and his few friends who were who he had recruited in the ward, a couple other young men in the ward that he had recruited to help him out. And you know, they were all arrested and taken off to prison. And finally, Helmut was killed. I think he was beheaded. Is that true?
Guillotine.
Or the guillotine. And so, you know, I look at our situation today where in the United States, you know, we're actually very lucky because our government, despite the terrible things that they do abroad, they treat American citizens, minus some who are Muslim now, but by and large treat American citizens very well. And if we go out and protest or do something against the government, nothing's going to happen to us. We're not going to get, you know, put in jail for years and years. We're not going to be killed. The worst that can happen is we get, you know, some type of a trespassing ticket, and you know, we go to jail for a night, and that's it. And yet, how many of us are actually willing to do that, even when the consequences of doing so are so much smaller than they were for Helmut, for example? And so, you know, during the time that I've been here in the United States, I haven't done anything against the war. You know, I get back to Provo and I hang out with my friends, and that, you know, we go to parties and we meet girls, and I go mountain biking, and you know, I go to work and try to make some money to pay my student loans, and that's life, you know. While at the same time, Iraqis are being killed in great numbers as a result of the war. You know, Palestinians are being killed and their economy destroyed, and Palestinians are being detained, you know, as a result of what our the United States government is doing abroad. So in that regard, you know, it's almost makes me feel quite ashamed to even think that I'm getting an award being compared to Helmut Huebner. On the other hand, maybe, you know, the state of activism in the LDS Church is so grim that, well, maybe I'm the only one there is. I don't know. Which is further saddening. So, I have been, though, you know, especially recently, met a number of people who, you know, Robert, especially, who really do care about these things and spend a good deal of their time, you know, trying to change people's views about the war and about other, you know, really important issues. Despite the fact that, you know, he could be doing other things, he could be spending time with his kids, or, you know, trying to make more money so he's got a better retirement and buy a bigger home and whatever else it is that all of us end up doing. So in that regard, again, it's both a shame, or an honor and a shame, to be compared to Helmut Huebner. Just to give or to say a few things about how I ended up in Iraq and maybe what I was doing there, I guess, because it's the sexy thing. Most people like to hear about how I got kidnapped and whatnot, but so I guess I'll, you know, say a few things about it. But as I guess I'll just maybe start from the beginning. When I was on my mission in Germany, I met a lot of people from Turkey who were all Muslims, and ended up being able to teach a few of them. Never ended up, you know, baptizing anyone who was Muslim, but always had these really great conversations. There were so many similarities between Islam and Mormonism that I just got me really interested in. I was like, wow, they've got a post-biblical prophet just like us. They've got a post-biblical book of scripture that's, you know, 600 or 700 pages thick, you know, just like we do. And it always frustrated me on my mission talking to other Christians who, when I would say, hey, you know, God gave another book of scripture, and look, Jesus, you know, visited the Americas and preached to people there. You know, Christianity is not just for Europeans. God cared enough to send the gospel to other peoples around the world as well. And, you know, the general response from Germans was, well, who cares? You know, they didn't care. And that was always really weird to me. So when these Muslims were coming to me saying, hey, here's this book, and we have a prophet, Muhammad, and so on and so forth, I thought, well, you know, just out of common courtesy, I should check it out and not just dismiss it like all these other people that dismiss the Book of Mormon and so on and so forth. And so that got me really interested in Islam. And then when I got back to, you know, home from my mission, I read a lot of stuff on my own and then finally decided that it would be a good idea to start taking Arabic. I didn't really know why. I just kind of had a feeling. My sister had been to the Jerusalem Center in Palestine there in Jerusalem. Had taken some Arabic, and I just thought, oh, that would be a good idea. So I started taking Arabic my last year at BYU, even though I was a German major, and thought to myself, well, boy, that would be great to do a study abroad. You know, on my mission, the only way I learned German was by being in Germany. I took German all throughout high school, and I hated it. That was my worst subject, you know. And so I decided, well, I'll do a study abroad, and I started looking into it, and I found this program at Beer Zeit University, near Ramallah, outside of Jerusalem in the West Bank. And on the website, it was saying all these things about come see life under occupation, and, you know, talked about a variety of things that the Israeli army was doing to Palestinians at the time. And this was 2003, so the Intifada was going pretty strong. And I thought, occupation, what's that? You know, I used to read the newspapers, what would go on in Israel and Palestine, and I never knew that Palestine was under occupation. I just knew that there was fighting, and I could never make any sense of what I really read in the newspapers. It was all very confusing. So I thought, wow, that doesn't seem very right, that there are Israeli soldiers and, you know, occupying Palestinian cities and arresting everyone, and maybe I better go check this out and I can learn, you know, some Arabic in the process. So when I got there, it was just a shock. I couldn't believe it, what I was seeing with the Israeli army everywhere, checkpoints surrounding every city, and just, you know, talking to the Palestinians that I lived with and seeing, you know, what kind of life they lived and how they had all had this many relatives killed and this many relatives in prison, if not, and many of the guys I ended up becoming friends with had been to prison themselves. And seeing how the Israeli soldiers harassed and scared everybody at the checkpoints, and how the Israeli soldiers would drive into town and arrest people, and everyone was just really scared. So it turns out that the weekend that the United States invaded Iraq, I was in a Palestinian city called Nablus, and the Israeli army invaded Nablus that weekend as well. Normally the army is just in the outskirts of town and they maintain their checkpoints and have like a kind of an economic siege and give everyone a hard time, but only so often do they actually go into the middle of Palestinian cities and kill people and arrest people and so forth. And so while I was there, that was very eye-opening, you know, walking through the streets of Nablus and hearing, gunfights going on just one street over, and at night going to sleep with gunfire going on between Palestinian guerrillas and Israeli soldiers outside the door or outside of our house that we were staying in. And there was a couple times when I thought, you know, some Israeli soldiers were pretty close to shooting me as well. So it was a pretty strange experience. And then, again, in the middle of that, the U.S. was about to invade Iraq. And there was, Palestinians in Nablus did a demonstration against the Iraq war. And, so we were there and walking around. I had this group of kids that, surrounded me with sticks. And they were, like, you know, being my bodyguards, basically. I was walking through the streets of Nablus, and there was just this big protest. All the Palestinian factions were there, Hamas, PFLP, Fatah, DFLP. They all had their flags there. And, you know, they were all protesting, the war against Iraq. And so I just remember thinking, well, this is what the Israeli occupation of Palestine is doing to Palestinians. I've got a good feeling that when the United States invades Iraq and occupies Iraq, it's probably going to be pretty similar. And so at that point in time, I started following things in Iraq pretty closely, and it's also an Arabic-speaking country, and I thought what was going on in Palestine was very wrong, and so I figured, once again, what the United States is going to do in Iraq would be similar. So it was there in Palestine that I met a guy who worked for Christian Peacemaker Teams in Hebron. And what Christian Peacemaker Teams would do in Palestine is go to checkpoints where Palestinians were, you know, being detained or the Israeli soldiers were preventing them from passing through, just so they could, like, go home at the end of the night. Palestinians are beaten at checkpoints oftentimes and things like this. And if there were Westerners there, then that would kind of make the Israeli soldiers be on their best behavior, so to speak, because it was embarrassing for them or just for other people in the West to see really what they were kind of doing there in the West Bank. And so CPT had a project in Hebron, and that's the type of stuff that they were doing, walking children to school that would get Palestinian children to school in the mornings and walking them back in the afternoons, because these kids would oftentimes get harassed and attacked by Israeli settlers. And so on and so forth. So, you know, when I met this guy, Chris Brown was his name, and he was telling me about what they're doing, I was really impressed. It turns out about 2 years later, Chris Brown, when I was actually going through training for CPT, we got word that Chris Brown was attacked by settlers while walking some Palestinian kids to school just outside of Hebron, and they beat him down pretty good and actually punctured his lung, and, you know, he spent a while in the hospital. But at any rate, that was my first exposure to CPT, and so when I got home, that's actually when I started school at Harvard. I was doing a 2-year master's degree, and I kept thinking about Iraq, and I had heard that CPT was opening a project in Iraq as well. So just throughout the whole time I was at Harvard, I was kind of following events in Iraq very closely and also, you know, following as best I could what CPT was doing. And decided when I graduated from school that I wanted to go to Baghdad and volunteer for CPT. And what they were doing at the time primarily was looking for, Iraqi families would come to them and say, hey, look, our son or brother or father was detained by the Americans. We don't know whether he's alive or whether he's dead. We can't find him anywhere. Could you guys, you know, help us? Being Americans, you can go on to the military bases and talk to the U.S. Army and so forth, try to find some information about where our relative is. And so there was a big need for that, and CPT ended up focusing on that basically full-time. And I was reading about how they did that, and I just felt this, you know, sympathy for Iraqis, thinking, you know, again, given my experience in Palestine, knowing, you know, how miserable things must be under American occupation, that would be really a nice thing to be able to go and try to help out some of these families. So that's the reason that I initially ended up going to Iraq. Turns out, you know, the situation in Iraq is actually, it's very different from the situation in Palestine in some ways, and it's very much the same in other ways. It's much more complicated in Iraq. It's not a black and white, you know, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. There's so many armed groups there, and so many people are engaged in a lot of violence. It's even very difficult to figure out who's doing what. Every time someone is murdered and their body is, you know, found floating in the Tigris River, or there, you know, you find someone's body who's been shot in the head and tortured, and their body is laying on the side of the road, it's very hard to figure out who's doing that. Whether it's Shia militias loyal to Iran, the Iraqi police, which was largely infiltrated by Shia militias that were loyal to Iran, whether it was Sunni insurgent groups, whether those Sunni insurgent groups were nationalist Iraqis, fighting against the occupation, or whether it was insurgents or terrorists from Al-Qaeda who were just killing Shiites because of religious reasons, whether it was the Iranian intelligence, you know, every time a car bomb goes off. Remember, even one time here in the States, reading an article about an Egyptian ambassador who was walking through the streets in Baghdad one day and just went to go buy a newspaper, and he was kidnapped and later murdered, like a couple days later. And the assumption in the U.S. press at that time, or at least, you know, in this particular article, was that, you know, a Sunni insurgent / Al-Qaeda group had kidnapped him and killed him, because the fact that Egypt had an ambassador there was giving legitimacy to, like, the puppet government of the Americans. And then later on, I read in an Arabic newspaper or magazine, actually, that in fact that operation had been done by Iranian intelligence, that Iranian intelligence had kidnapped this Iraqi ambassador and killed him. At any rate, it's just very confusing what's going on there. But I did really enjoy the work, and was just felt like it was really important to try and do something to help these other people, and or to help Iraqis as best you could, despite, you know, all these different armed groups that were active, you know, including the U.S. Army. Another thing that CPT ended up doing a lot of was that after all these people that they helped locate in different prisons, after, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 months, a lot of these people finally started getting released from U.S. custody. And families would have parties when their, you know, sons would get out of detention, for example, and they would always invite CBT to come to the party and you know, have a little homecoming thing, a little bit like coming home from a mission, you know. You invite all your relatives, and it's kind of like a big party. And what they found is that all these Iraqis that were getting released from American custody, that many of them had been tortured, you know, beaten very badly, sexually abused, and things like this. And so they thought, well, you know, we should put together a report about this, try to raise awareness about it, send it to the UN, send it to the media to get the word out that, look, this is what's happening to Iraqis under U.S. custody. And so they did that. And just about the same time they put their report out, the ICRC, or the International Committee of the Red Cross, had written a similar report, which is normally private and not ever released to the public, but that was leaked somehow. So there was that was a pretty credible source that indicated that Iraqis were being tortured by Americans. And then, of course, all the photos about Abu Ghraib came out, you know, a few weeks actually after that. And so then it was pretty obviously difficult to deny that this type of stuff was going on in U.S. prisons. And so, again, this had all happened, too, before I got to Iraq with CPT, and I was thought that that was really good work and was important stuff to do. So that's why I wanted to go. And I didn't ever, I mean, I was nervous to go. I remember in Amman, Jordan, where I stayed one night before going to Baghdad the first time, I just felt terribly sick to my stomach. I was like, man, you know, going to Baghdad, all you ever read about are bombings and kidnappings and beheadings and things like that. So obviously I was worried, but I knew that these, you know, these Americans from CPT were there, and they said it was okay to come. So I figured, well, I guess we'll go for it. And so while I was in Baghdad, I mean, obviously those type of things were a worry. But then at the same time, it's a city, and Iraqis are living there, and you just kind of get into the routine of things. And so occasionally, you know, in your back of your mind, it's there, like, oh, maybe something could happen. But you just kind of go about life, you know, just regardless of the fact that that possibility is there. And so it's important to remember that that is how life has been for Iraqis ever since 2003. There was a lot of fear of Saddam's regime at the time, but or before the U.S. came. But at the same time, if you just kind of stayed out of politics and minded your own business, life was normal. You go out, go have picnics, and you know, go out to restaurants and eat, and so on and so forth. There wasn't the random violence that there is now, where anytime you leave the house, there could be a bombing. Anytime you leave the house, there's such lawlessness that there could be a kidnapping. And it's not most of the people that get kidnapped in Iraq are actually Iraqis. They just get kidnapped for money or even a lot of times due to their ethnicity and so forth because of the sectarian war that's broken out. But most people that get kidnapped there are Iraqis, and that is a major fear of people, is one, to get killed in a bombing, secondly, to get kidnapped, third, that the U.S. Army is going to come, or the Iraqi police and the Ministry of Interior, that they're going to come and break your door down and take you or your relatives away for really no reason. When I was in Iraq, most of the torture that was going on shifted from the Americans, because a lot had come to light about that in the U.S. media, and there's a pretty big outcry. And a lot of that torture shifted to the newly created U.S.-backed Iraqi security forces. In fact, I even met a U.S. soldier who told me that they would the U.S. soldiers would arrest people, and if they needed, you know, to interrogate someone, they'd hand them off to their Iraqi colleagues, who would torture them. And once they got the information they wanted, they'd give them back to the Americans. You know, so there was a lot of torture going on at the hands of the U.S.-backed Iraqi security forces. Terrible stuff, like, you know, people getting electric drills put through different parts of their body, people being hung from their ankles for long periods of time from the ceiling, electric shocks to the genitals, and all kinds of things. And then in addition to that, a lot of people would get tortured and then simply shot in the head and dumped by the side of the road. So this is kind of the type of stuff that was going on even in 2005 when I was living there. And in fact, things were much better then than they are now. It's gotten even worse. So, you know, think of how worried I was just as an American there for a couple months, but think about that for Iraqis, it's been that way for 4 years. 4 years of every day waking up, not knowing if your kids are going to get killed or kidnapped or something today, or your husband, relatives, etc. And in fact, now that type of thing is so widespread that I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that every single Iraqi family has been, you know, hit by one of those three crises: kidnapping, detention by the Americans, or, you know, being killed in a bombing. So, at any rate, that was kind of the climate. And finally, you know, my mom, bless her heart, was telling me, "Hey, Will, you know, you should really come home. It's not a really good idea for you to be there." And I was like, "Okay, you know, she's probably right. I better leave." And so I came home in after those first 4 months in Baghdad, and just a few, well, maybe about 2 months after I was home. Let me jump ahead. Okay. At any rate, four members of our organization ended up getting kidnapped, and one of those individuals, Tom Fox, who was my roommate when I was in Baghdad, was murdered after being held for 4 months. And so that was obviously very terrible, and as a result of that, CPT had to leave Baghdad. It was just too dangerous, and they ended up going to the Kurdish north, which is much more secure, and working there. So when I decided to go back to Iraq the second time, it wasn't like a suicide mission. I was thinking, oh, I'm in the Kurdish north, it's very secure, there's no bombings, and it's pretty safe, and that's, everything's going to be fine. I was telling my parents, oh, don't worry about it. Before I went, I wasn't nervous one bit. Everything's going to be fine. And then finally, you know, we were traveling down a road one day in February, because it's out in a pretty remote area, out in the desert, and some gunmen stopped our car. And first said, oh, well, we're from the Iraqi border police. We just need to do a quick investigation. You know, not a big deal. And this a young guy with an AK-47 got in the front seat of our car. Another group of guys with guns were in this old beat-up Volkswagen, and they started driving off into the desert. And the gunman in our car said, follow them. So we start driving out into the desert. And after... I mean, I guess I'm a pretty trusting guy. Like, at first, I didn't really think, you know, there's a lot of checkpoints in Iraq and so forth. Then I look out and I'm like, man, we're just heading straight down to the desert. There's no police headquarters. I mean, it's like driving between St. George and Las Vegas. I mean, it's just like there's nothing there on each side. And we're driving out in the desert. And at that point, you know, I thought about all the stories I had heard where Iraqis had just been stopped at, say, a police checkpoint. And again, you know, taken out of their car, tortured, shot in the head, and their body dumped on the side of the road. That was very common. And that's what I thought was going to happen. I just thought, you know, these guys are just going to take us out, and they're just driving us out into some deserted spot in the desert. They're going to pull us out of the car, and they're just going to shoot us all in the head, and that's it. So that was a really interesting time because, you know, I remember just kind of staring out the window, just thinking that I was going to be dead in about 5 minutes. And as they always say in the movies, you know, your life flashes before your eyes, and that's totally true. I don't know who ever first put it in the movies, but that's true. That happens. And I was thinking about what I had done. I was like, yeah, that's it. My life, it's over. What I've done is done. And I thought about the good things I had done. And I'd done a couple, you know, a few good things. And I thought about the bad things I had done. And I'd done some bad things. And I tell you, when you really feel like you're about to die, you start to see the meaning of life pretty clearly. When you're here living in the U.S. and life is good and this and that, you know, there's all kinds of things that are important and you get distracted by. And you know, I got to go buy this new shirt, or there's this car I want, or, you know, my job is really important, or I don't know, whatever, you know, watching NFL football on Sundays, you know, I got to watch this game. It's going to be awesome. Those things all seem pretty important. But when you're really about, feel like you're pretty confident you're going to be dead in the next couple minutes or seconds, you see what's important in life pretty clearly. And to me, what I thought of was like, wow, you know, what's important in life is, on the one hand, keeping the commandments, and secondly, helping other people. That's it. Everything else, it really doesn't matter. That's it. And that hopefully has stuck with me, because then, again, I was kidnapped for about 9 days. My kidnappers actually, there were a few close calls where I was pretty worried I would get killed again, but by and large, they were pretty nice to me. And, they weren't beating me up or anything. They gave me plenty of food and stuff like that. And then when I was finally released, I made it out of it. And hopefully the memory of what I was thinking and feeling right in those moments before I die, or before I thought I was going to die, will stick with me. And hopefully for the rest of my life, I can try to keep that in perspective that, man, what's really important is helping people and keeping the commandments. And it's been hard since I've been home. It's the same thing. There's parties. My friends want to go out and go to parties. I love going to parties and meeting girls or going mountain biking or going to the gym, whatever else. And once again, I just get distracted away from what the important things are. And so I think maybe just a challenge to everybody here, including to myself, is, how can we spend our time to do something good for other people? And obviously, in my opinion, a big part of that is to try and, resist the current war that our government is fighting in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and try to do a better job of following the example of Helmut Huebner and making that really a priority in our lives, to try and do the right thing, stand up for what's right and for what's true. And I guess I'll go ahead and end with that.
At this point, we have about 5 minutes left. Are there any questions? I was thinking myself, this is one big question. Why would he go there? But there are other questions.
The fact that you were there really as a friend, did that make any difference to your safety at all, or not?
To some degree, it did. There were people that I met that were members of the Ba'ath Party that were, currently fighting against the U.S. occupation there. I don't think I ever met anyone that was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. I don't know whether they would have been cool with me or not. I have no idea. I met people from the Mahdi Army, which I was there in 2005, but the Mahdi Army had fought an uprising against the U.S. military. That's a Shiite militia loyal to Muqtada Assad. Mm-hmm. They had fought an uprising against the U.S. in Najaf and Kabul in 2004. And those guys were very friendly and very nice, even though these kids themselves, they were young guys, 18, 19 years old, they had all participated in the battle against the American forces. But because I wasn't there with the gun or as part of the military, I was with the Human Rights Organization, they were by and large very friendly. But the problem is, in Iraq, there's just so much crime that, again, that's why Iraqi civilians are getting kidnapped and killed all the time, just for money or just for whatever random reason. I mean, the whole society is just basically falling apart.
We hear about the Stockholm syndrome, where the kidnapped victim really gets to like the kidnappers. Did you experience that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it is a weird phenomenon, and I try to take the attitude that, hey, I'm going to be friendly to these guys, because what if they get, the guy who was immediately responsible for me and would sleep in the room and so on and so forth, he'd always say, hey, if it were up to me, I'd help you out. Like, I don't have a problem with you, but my boss, And I, at the time I believed him. In retrospect, I never saw the boss, and so I'm pretty sure it was him running the show. But I mean, he was a pretty nice guy to me. I could speak some Arabic, and so I could actually talk to him about politics and all these different things. But at the very least, number one, I thought I shouldn't have any hatred for the guy just because I'm a Mormon or a Christian. Secondly, I thought, if we're kind of buddies, if the boss ever decides that I should be killed, and he tells this guy to kill me, that maybe he, would think twice about pulling the trigger. But, he was a pretty funny guy, and, we'd even joke around and things like that. And it also made it easier, because he was a pretty nice guy to me. He never beat me. He never tried to, make the conditions as comfortable as possible. And he maybe been reading a book currently called Enemy Combatant, about a British guy of Pakistani origin who was held in, who was arrested in Pakistan, held at a prison in at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, and then in Guantanamo. He's in Afghanistan for a year, and in Guantanamo for 2 years, and in Guantanamo he was in solitary confinement for the entire 2 years. And you read about other stories of how people are treated in U.S. custody. They're getting beat or yelled at all the time, or waterboarded where they think they're about to drown, or they're got threats against their family or against their religion and so forth. So in retrospect, it was really easy for me to even feel good feelings toward the kidnapper, whether I should have or shouldn't, because he was doing something terrible to me. But it's pretty easy because they actually treated me decently well. And I even saw that in the book that this fellow wrote, because some of the U.S. guards were very nice to him and like treated him with a lot of respect and so forth, and others treated him really badly. So maybe whether that was the stereotypical Stockholm syndrome, I don't know, maybe it was, but maybe a combination of all those things.
Your address of the presidential candidate, what would your solution be for a riot that was at the time?
It's really hard. I mean, my sense is, the situation is so complicated and it's such a disaster now. I mean, I think the terrible thing was that the war was begun in the first place. But I think if the U.S. actually said to the different factions, hey, we're willing to pull out, truly, we'll negotiate a withdrawal with the insurgent factions, we'll negotiate, a withdrawal with all the different armed groups in the country, because all of them don't want the U.S. there, but the Shiites are fighting the Sunnis and so forth. Even a lot of Sunni insurgent groups are fighting against al-Qaeda currently. And so it's just a big mess. And that's my sense, is that if the U.S. would say, hey, we're prepared to leave, we don't want to be here, we're not going to have a military basis here, we're not going to continue to push through this law that privatizes the Iraqi oil industry and so forth, we'll get out of Iraq and just take our hands away from it, that there could possibly be a way to negotiate, a kind of a peace deal between all the different armed groups that are there. Whether it's possible, I don't know. It's just so complicated. I wish I had a clear-cut answer. But just in terms of presidential candidates, I mean, I've been very impressed with Ron Paul, who's a Republican candidate, who has been pretty brave in some different debates, talking about the real reasons, for the Iraq War, about the real reasons for why there's a lot of hostility towards the U.S. and the Middle East. Dennis Kucinich is another good guy, although I don't really agree with his pro-choice stance, but he's really good on a lot of other issues. So those would maybe be the two that I think are best candidates, to maybe Kucinich on the Democratic side or Ron Paul on the Republican side.
You worked on a master's degree in theology at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
which you completed, right?
Yeah.
What drove that? What drove your interest in that? How was that experience? How did that affect your perspective?
Well, it was kind of interesting because just while I was at BYU, I was reading a lot of, again, like Marxist and communist type literature, which I realized pretty quick communism is not a good thing, but still ended up reading a lot of left-wing stuff and a lot of Noam Chomsky and so forth, and then started getting into what's called liberation theology, which are these kind of left-wing Christian movements, particularly among Catholics in Latin America in the 70s and 80s when there are all these U.S.-backed military dictatorships ruling most countries in South America. And so I just wanted to study liberation theology, and I found out that they had courses about it at Harvard Divinity School, and so I thought, well, I'll apply and threw an application together and managed to get in, maybe they have a Mormon quota system or something, because, oh, well, better have at least one Mormon, But between the time I applied to Divinity School, right after I'd finished my application to Divinity School is when I went to Palestine for that study abroad. And by the time I got back from Palestine, I was still interested in liberation theology, but more interested in Middle Eastern politics, etc. So that's actually what I started at Harvard, was more like Arabic and Middle Eastern studies type stuff, even though it was in the Divinity School. So.
Well,
Well, ladies and gentlemen, people applauded. Any resemblance? Well, thank you. Go ahead. One more? Okay. He's a nice guy.
You didn't have any money.
I probably can't say. I wish I could, but I guess I better not.
All right. Well, thank you, William, for accepting the 2007 Helmut Human Award, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us.
Good job.